assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl get near the Buddha's throne while I cannot?" Shakyamuni said, "Bring her out of her samadhi and ask her yourself." Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapped his fingers once, took her up to the Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of her meditation, but in vain. The world-honored one said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up." But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva Momyo. He will be able to arouse her from her samadhi. Instantly, the Bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the world-honored one, who gave him his imperial order. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of her samadhi. Mumon's comment: old Shakyamuni put a petty drama on the stage and failed to enlighten the masses. I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he arouse the girl from her samadhi? How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva at the beginner's stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness. Mumon's verse: one was successful, the other was not. Both secured freedom of mind. One in a god mask, the other in a devil mask. Even in defeat, a beautiful performance. This is an interesting koan from the Mumonkan, the U Menkuan. It is a kind of a fantastic story, sort of like a mythical event. It imagines the Buddha surrounded by an entourage of bodhisattvas and enlightened beings. And there is next to him, he's like a monarch at a court. So this is a little bit weird. But the Buddha is like a king in a court, and all the bodhisattvas are like arrayed around his throne. And next to his throne is a girl sitting. And she is closer to the Buddha than Manjushri. And he says, "Why is it that she can be closer to your throne than I can?" And he says, "Well, if you wake her out of her samadhi, you'll have the answer." And Manjushri, who is considered to be a bodhisattva of wisdom, can't wake her up out of her samadhi, no matter what he does. And then the Buddha says, "But you know, there's a little bodhisattva whose name is Momyo, and he can do it." And Momyo just springs out of the earth like a little elf or something. And he goes over to the girl and snaps his fingers, and she comes right out of her samadhi. This is so. In other words, this really didn't happen in history. this is about this is a koan constructed to help us understand what we're doing on the cushion. And many of you are, you know, in a good place to hear this little story, because you all have been practicing with such diligence. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the stages of Zen practice today, so that people don't get confused about what might be happening. When we start sitting, often we come to the Zendo with all kinds of personal urgencies and troubles, and we're usually very eager to get some kind of a release from our troubles. Or we feel that life is really missing something important, and we're looking for something. And so the initial stage of meditation practice is a cultivation of, you might say, mind-mental control, or mental focus. So we start with the breath perception koan, and people watch the breath until they can develop a mental focus. This is sometimes called one-pointedness of mind. So normally our thoughts pull us, our thoughts and emotions pull us in one direction after another. In a fashion we don't actually control. It's very interesting. We think we are thinking, we are the masters of our thoughts, but actually our thoughts pull us in different directions, and we're dragged along by our thoughts. It's kind of an odd way to put it, but it's actually true. Thoughts spring up out of your head, and they produce emotional responses. So you might be thinking about, you know, you're sitting on the cushion, and you might begin to think about a relationship with somebody at work. And you might think, you know, she really hates me. And then you begin to feel either anger or fear, right? And then, you know, other thoughts follow. But, you know, really, you aren't creating. It's odd to say, but you aren't actually creating your own thoughts. They're just popping into your head. And then you're saying, oh, this is me, these are mine. And you're having various kinds of emotional responses, see. This is a very unhealthy situation, even though most people think it's normal. They're under the illusion that they are the creators of their own thoughts. But really, thoughts are just created by language. They're just words and cultural behaviors. And they just circulate around like money. You know, ideas are really just like money. You know, a dollar bill goes from my hand to your hand, or at the end of the session, from your hand into my hand. And you can say it's my dollar bill, but actually the dollar bill doesn't belong to anybody. It just circulates, right? And ideas are just like that, see. They're just like that. They're just currency. There's nothing really yours about ideas. When we're pulled around by our ideas, our thoughts, and our mental reflections, you know, we think this is all under our control, but it's not. And people who are mentally ill, you know, some people become mentally ill because they can't stop thinking. This is actually quite common. Various personality disorders, and also various forms like schizophrenia. These people have an obsessive compulsive relation to thought. So, for example, they'll go to a party and they'll meet somebody that they wanted to impress. And they'll say, you know, maybe it's the boss, and you say, "Hello, Mr. Sturgis." "Hello, Mrs. Sturgis. My, that's a wonderful dress." And Sturgis looks at you and says, "Oh, hello, what was your name again?" You know, and you go, you know, "So-and-so, Spellmeyer." "Oh, Spellmeyer. Oh, I'm glad you could make it." Okay, so then you go home and you sit in your chair and you think, what did he mean by that? I'm glad you could make it. You know, I don't think he was glad at all, you know. I think he really hates me. Or does he? You know? And then you just go round and round and right? And normally people at some point just say, "Oh well, maybe he hates me. I'm gonna get some dinner," right? But there are people who can't stop thinking about this, right? And it's like they go to bed thinking about it, and they get up thinking about it, eventually you're on a loop, that you can't get off of. And then, you know, people have to go, like, to the psychiatrist and ask for help. Eventually, you become dysfunctional because you can't stop thinking and analyzing obsessively. Usually this produces, like, paranoia. These are all common symptoms, like paranoia, you feel threatened, persecution. This is very widespread in our society because our society puts such a big importance on ideas, you know. So, you know, most people who come to a Zendo are not schizophrenic, but they may have personality disorders, and indeed they tend to be, you know, compulsive in certain ways. And not always, of course, but this is often the case, you know. So people come to the Zendo and they learn to develop a one-pointedness of mind. You learn to focus on the breath and let the thoughts go by. And this is just beginner's Zen. But this is so important. This is so crucial. Not to be possessed by your thoughts, but to let them go by. Let them go by. Focus the mind on the breath. Focus. This is the beginning of liberation. Don't let anybody tell you that breath, perception, meditation isn't important. This is the foundation of all subsequent practice. And it's the beginning of your liberation as a human being from the sort of the slavery of thought. Okay. So this is stage number one. You begin to be able to resist thought, not be taken over, possessed by thought, and you begin to focus on the breath. And if you focus on the breath long enough, and thoughts begin to go by like clouds in the sky, you begin to feel better, and you begin to have this wonderful, wonderful experience of sort of spaciousness. It's like living in a neighborhood all the time where you have to be careful or you're going to get beaten up, right? I know this from experience, because as a boy, my father was stationed at Fort Holabird in Baltimore. We lived in an apartment complex. And just getting to school was like a major issue. It was like, can I get to school and back today without getting beaten up or not, right? And it was just a tough neighborhood. And if I got through a week without having a fight, I was just, you know, I was just elated. Notice I didn't say winning a fight, because that never happened, right? But fortunately, I did get through some weeks, you know, without getting beaten up. But, you know, when you move out of that neighborhood, as we did, and then you move to this lovely place in southern Virginia called Yorktown, as I did, I felt so much better, you know. First of all, there weren't any people around to beat me up. There were trees and woods, you know, and the York River was so beautiful, I could go walking by the river. It was fantastic. You know? Well, this is a little bit like what happens to us when we stop being controlled by our thoughts. You know, you begin to have this freedom, this wonderful freedom. And then, you know, you can begin to liberate yourself from another kind of slavery, which is slavery to conditioning, right? But like body conditioning. So just as thoughts are really not yours, you know, they're like money circulating, actually body is really not quite yours either, because people have been shaping it and prodding it and conditioning you all your life to have certain responses, you know. So, you know, you can be conditioned to be afraid every time you see a bowl of water, you know, if somebody gives you electroshock or something, you know. After a while, you don't have to get the shock, you just feel terror when you look at a bowl of water. This is a psychologist-type experiment, right? A primitive Pavlovian conditioning. But this is done to us all the time. You know, every time we turn on TV, it's like primitive Pavlovian conditioning, right? And so your body, its wants and needs, the way you feel comfortable, the way you feel uncomfortable, all of these have been created by people who don't necessarily have your liberation at heart. So, you know, when people design chairs, they designed chairs not actually for maximum health, right? They certainly don't design chairs for maximum awareness, right? Mental focus. They design chairs that will be very, very comfy, right? So, you know, like the Lazy Boy type chair, or the chair where you can just sink into the padded leather, you know, and feel totally comfortable. So, you know, you're conditioned to desire that state by, you know, so society says this is what you should want. We design chairs that do this. You know, you learn how to arrange your body this way. But this is not necessarily a good thing for you. So when you sit on a cushion on a mat in this weird posture, actually, believe it or not, this posture is very good. You might not believe it right now if your legs are screaming, but this is very good for you. You know, meditation physically is very good for you. There's a medical doctor who is the head of endocrinology at Robert Wood Johnson, and he comes to sit with us sometimes on Monday nights. He's traveling a lot, but he does come periodically to sit with us, and he's been studying the endocrine system and meditation, and he says it has a huge positive effect on the body's health. You know, I'm the only person in my immediate family who isn't on thyroid medicine. My mother is on thyroid medicine. My brother has a very severe thyroid condition. My sister is on, you know, some of the people in my family have had to have their thyroids removed. I go in every time, and the doctor says, you know, I don't understand it. Everything's fine, you know. Blood pressure, perfect, you know. And this is not characteristic of people in my family. I actually attribute this to meditation, and there's a ton of evidence that this is true. So, you know, basically, you're freeing the mind from thought, and you're deconditioning the body and letting it return to, believe it or not, a much more natural and healthy state. In fact, you know, if you just take a baby and you sit him down, he'll try to cross his legs. No, I just made that up. That part is not true. But everything up to then really is true. This really is good for you. And it's really like deconditioning. Very good for you. Very good for you. So, you know, phase one is one-pointedness of mind. And you begin to feel better. But then you have to deal with this pain, right? This pain issue. And mental fatigue issues and so on. And this is like freeing the body on a deeper level. See, you're deconditioning. It's relatively, believe it or not, it's relatively, although it's a great accomplishment not to be pulled around by our thoughts, it's relatively easy to do that. It's a little bit harder to transform to liberate the body, see. So that's a sort of stage two, liberating the body. So, you know, when you're sitting in samadhi on the cushion, watching the breath or calling mu, and this pain is arising and you're pushing it away, this is a liberation practice, I swear to you. And what will eventually happen, well, at any rate, you will eventually enter a samadhi state, right? Deep samadhi. Where you may, as I've mentioned, you'll feel your face or hands disappearing, you'll feel like you're expanding, you'll feel like you're floating perhaps. And you in this deep samadhi state, you'll often have like real blissful experience, you know. You really have returned to a more natural state. So, you know, maybe you're in pain all morning, but every time you resist the desire to move, every time you resist the desire to move, you're deepening your samadhi, and you just go deeper and deeper. You know, sooner or later, you will have a sit where your pain just goes away, and it's wonderful. You know, the pain goes away. You begin to feel more connected to everything. You have this wonderful, beautiful feeling, And this is the foundation of all Zen practice, is being able to enter into this this state of fusion with the moment. You know, this is the natural state. And many of you have achieved this at this session. You know, it's up or down, right? You know, some of you came in last night and said, you know, wow, this is fantastic. You know, my pain is going away. You might have gotten up this morning eagerly thinking, well, now this is going to be great, no more pain. You know, I can remember when I went, that happened to me at a session. We had a session at a place called Moses Lake in Washington State. Beautiful place. There were coyotes howling every night. We'd all leave the Zendo and you'd hear the coyotes howling. It was beautiful. It's out in the desert part of Washington State. And I remember sitting one night and just the pain just dropped away, and I went in to see the Roshi and Dokusan, and I said, Genki Roshi, you know, the pain is, I will never, I see, I'm free from pain, I will never feel pain again. He didn't say a word, he said, that's very nice, or wonderful, you know, very good, you know. Next day, you know. But when you do this, little by little, you're liberating the mind, deconditioning the body. You enter this more natural state, and you will have sits where you feel just wonderful. You know, these are powerful, beautiful experiences. See, this is deep samadhi. However, you know, it's very important. You must be able to enter samadhi to do the more advanced stages of meditation. But it's very important to understand that samadhi is actually not liberation. It's not complete liberation. It's not enlightenment. Okay? It's a wonderful state of freedom, and it's a wonderful state of freedom from all of these things, thoughts, bad conditioning, and so on. But it's not the end of the path. In fact, when the Buddha was alive, there were people who taught that samadhi was enlightenment, that this is it, you know, that blissful state. And you will meet many people in the world who are practicing continuous samadhi. They just get into samadhi. They could become sort of like samadhi junkies, you know, and they just want to have these beautiful peak experiences. And let me just say, if you've had some, please enjoy them, treasure them all your life, you know, because they're wonderful. And, you know, you will be going into samadhi for the rest of your meditation practice. But the truth is that is not awakening, because, you know, samadhi is, you know, when you're sitting on the cushion going, this is fantastic, this is wonderful, this is heaven, and so on and so on. It's actually, I'm not putting it down, because it's a great achievement, but it's still rather selfish, as a matter of fact, right? It's rather self-centered. It's sort of like saying all is right with me, right? You know, and if you get off the cushion, you know, you may find you may have this beautiful samadhi experience. Somebody may step on your toes in the kitchen, you know, and you may suddenly feel really mad, you know. And it's like you're sitting on the cushion, you're thinking, I am Buddha, this is it, you know. All's right with the world, you know. And then you're in the kitchen, you oaf, you know, you idiot. Or you think, I just don't like that guy's nose, you know, I just don't like his nose. So samadhi is not enlightenment. And it's very important, part of the message of this koan, is that there's something beyond, I can't really do justice to this very complicated koan today, but part of the message, you might think, well, why would you want to come out of samadhi? Why bring the girl out of samadhi? Isn't samadhi what we're trying to achieve? Yes and no. Because stage one is liberation from thought, and deconditioning the body, and then basically entering samadhi. But then that's a first stage of Zen practice. Now, if you're not there yet, you know, just keep plugging. It'll happen. And if you're there, fantastic. You know, wonderful. And it took an incredible amount of work and training to get there. But the next stage of Zen practice is liberation from, we could say, purification of the heart, if you want to put it that way. In other words, when we're in samadhi, we're still in the perspective, to some degree, of ourself, you know, personal self. It's our experience, and so on and so on. And there's limits to our sense of connection to things, even though we feel intensely that connection. You know, so the next stage of Zen practice is the mu koan, right? The mu koan. And this is hard work. It's sort of hard to leave the beauty of samadhi behind. That, you know, watching the breath, beautiful, blissful experience, and then you have to begin to work with mu koan. And so this, instead of watching your breath, you call mu on each out breath, mu on each out breath. See, and you're supposed to be. It's supposed to be following the breath out, out, out to that blank or empty space inside that you see when you look in your mind's eye. So if you watch the breath for a while and you look in your mind and you see blankness or an empty space, that's where you want your consciousness to go. Okay? And so, you know, you might be starting to do that and you think, so far, so good. Blank, 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 excellent. Okay, then you go to bed and you get up the next day. And instead of being in a very pure, connected state, you may have a mind full of thoughts, right? It's like your mind is just a jumble of thoughts. And you might think, oh my gosh, you know, I'm back at square one again. You know, here I am on day four of a sesshin, and my mind is just like, I haven't even come to sesshin. It's like my mind is just this mess. You know, all this stuff, all these thoughts. What's wrong with me? You know, I knew I wasn't going to wake up. You know, I knew I couldn't get rid of this. But please don't be deceived by that, because you've entered a different level of Zen training. You know, this is a different level. You know, ordinary mind has thoughts that work sort of in a rational, sequential way. And they're very shallow thoughts. So, for example, you might think, I've got to renew my driver's license by July 1. Where shall I do it? You know, there's always a big line in, you know, Hightstown. Maybe I'll go to Plainfield and I'll renew it there. You know, that's a sort of rational thought, right? Sort of ordinary, shallow thinking. But when you're working with the mu koan, you may suddenly find that all of these strange things come up into your head. You know, you get up, you come in to do zazen with an open heart. We recite the sutras, you do your bows, you sit down on the cushion, you start calling mu, you face the blankness, and then, you know, I'd like to buy the world a Coke. Keep it company. So this is this, and then you think, what is this? What the heck? And get, you know, get out of here, you know. And then the mo, and then. Okay. So this is absolutely predictable. You know, this is what has happened to you is that you're now entering a deeper level of awareness. This is not ordinary thinking. This is like the edge of your unconscious. Really and truly. In Sanskrit, this is called the alaya consciousness, the alaya vijnana. This is a great discovery of Indian Buddhism, was that there's this level of consciousness where it's like the storehouse, And it's a personal unconscious or personal mind. And so this is where the karma is stored, as a matter of fact. See, this is where your karma is kept. So all the events of your life are sort of stored away in the storehouse consciousness. People in the West didn't think along these lines until Sigmund Freud, but the East, people in the East knew about this for a long time. This was Buddhist meditators discovered this. In fact, you know, the difference between, say, Theravada practice and Mahayana, like Zen, I think is based upon the discovery of the importance of the unconscious. So, you know, basically, we can be aware of the moment, we can purify body and mind, and yet we're obstructed at more advanced levels because there's the action of this storehouse mind. And this is why you sit on the cushion and instead of entering, you go into the blankness and then the Coke song comes up. It's because this is like your storehouse mind starts releasing its contents into your field of awareness. This is absolutely true and it's absolutely predictable. And these are, and the thing is, though, in your storehouse mind, it's not like all the tapes of your life are stored. That's not how memory gets laid down. It's not how it is. Memory doesn't survive in coherent stories. It's just, there's little pieces of stuff in there. There's little piece, fragments of thoughts, fragmented memories. You know, there may be emotions stored there that are now separated from the events that produce the emotions. So actually, you may begin to feel like fear or anger, but you can't remember what caused it. You just feel the emotion. See, all of this stuff is laid down in a kind of haphazard way in your unconscious, and as the contents float up, it's not going to be a, you're not going to have a little story that becomes clear. Sometimes that'll happen. You'll realize, you know, now I know why my father used to, you know, drink so much. You know, now I understand. And that may happen. You know, something comes up and now you can see it again. But often it's just fragments or just strange emotions. Or, you know, you might just suddenly feel down. I don't know why, but I'm just suddenly depressed. Or you might feel kind of nervous. I don't know why, but I'm just kind of, I feel kind of nervous. You see, this is all just coming out. Mental chatter, you know. But this is not the same as the beginner's mental chatter. This is like at this stage of Zen practice, there can be this process of like working through the alaya, the storehouse mind. And, you know, basically this is your karma. So you know, actually, as I've said before, if you could just come in, sit on the cushion and experience bliss, right? If we could just come to Sesshin, sit down and bliss out, this would be a very dangerous practice, right? This would be like a drug, not liberation. Because we could beat somebody up, come to Sesshin, sit down, and bliss out, man. You know? Rob a bank, you know, come, and here comes enlightenment, you know. Indeed, if you just cultivate samadhi, actually, you must cultivate samadhi, because you need to have that unified awareness. But if you just stay with samadhi, you could indeed perhaps do terrible things off the cushion and come back and get back into this blissful state. So the path to liberation is mu xing, is meditating on emptiness. And when you begin to do that, it releases the contents of your storehouse mind. And now you come face to face with your karma in all of its fractured, fragmented way. And you just have to go one mu breath at a time through your karma. Right? through all this karma. And, you know, when you look at your karma, if you begin to realize, my God, it's immense. It's like a huge junkyard, right? You know, it's like, I have to clean that up. But, you know, don't, this is your karma. You have, there's no other way to achieve liberation except to work through it. And fortunately, it goes much more quickly than you would think. You know, in a Chinese tradition, this is represented by water dropping on a rock. In poetry, Chinese Zen poetry, and also Japanese Zen poetry, there's often this metaphor of water on the rock. In fact, it's even in the koan collections. And this symbolizes the stage of practice in which you use mu to purify your heart, to clean up your karma. See, so you just keep calling mu, and little by little the Coca-Cola song goes away. Maybe days, but little by little, there's no choice. You just have to clean it up. Maybe you encounter anger. You encounter, you know, something troubles you. Something makes you mad or upset. You just, goes away. Okay. And little by little, you know, like water dropping on the rock. The rock seems immovable, immense, and indestructible. Water seems so weak, you know, seems so weak and so powerless to change things. But water made the Grand Canyon, right? I mean, the Chinese were keen observers of nature, as were the Japanese. And they understood that in the Lao Tzu, for example, in the Tao Te Ching, the power of water is very keenly appreciated. Well, mu is your water dropping on the rock. So you just keep calling mu, and little by little, just have faith, have confidence in the process, and just keep cleaning up your karma. It's hard work to clean your karma, but on the other end of this is real liberation. And in the process, this is how people who do Zazen get to be better people. See, I mean, you can come to Sesshin and you feel a little better, and then you can go home and say, well, how can I practice Zen in my daily life? You know, maybe you have a short temper, you know, and you really blow your top. You know, something goes wrong at work and you just find yourself blowing your top, you know. So you come to Sesshin and you feel peaceful and happy, and then you come away from Sesshin and it lasts for a few days, and then something happens and boom, you blow your top. You know, and you think, damn it, I'm back where I was. You know, how can I integrate Zen into my life? Well, if you try to integrate Zen into your life, probably won't work. So if you're afraid, you know, you're about to blow your top, and you go, now, you know, calm down, think of Sesshin, you know, that's very feeble. It's not going to change your behavior very much. It's like people who, after Sesshin, you know, you remember in Sesshin looking at your tea bowl and just thinking, this is ecstasy. You know, this is heaven. You look at the tea bowl and think, this is perfection. Okay, a week later you're at home and you're having a cup of tea and the TV is on or something, and you think, wait a minute, I've got to experience, I've got to get back to that experience. You turn the TV off, you sit down, and you look at the tea bowl and go, come on now. But it doesn't happen, right? It's incredibly artificial, you know. So how do you become a better person? How do you integrate this? Just keep practicing. See, the more you sit, the more you practice, the automatically you become more awake in your daily life, more compassionate, more patient, more kind. And it takes many years. It takes many years of practice, but it's automatically transformative, and that's the only way you can be transformed. See, the acorn doesn't worry about becoming an oak tree; it just grows into an oak tree. It doesn't have to strive to be an oak tree. your true nature is to be bodhisattva. In fact, Buddha is already your true nature. And it, coming to Sesshin, you might think it's an attempt to become enlightened. But another way to put it is that your enlightened nature told you to come here, and that you're already manifesting your enlightened nature to a certain degree. So we're, one way to think of it is we're trying to achieve awakening, but it would be more true to say that our true self told us to come here, and we're learning how to manifest our true self more fully, or to serve our true self more fully. So everybody here, perhaps, is at a different stage in the continuum I've talked about. You know, we have to be able to develop a one-pointed mind, watching the breath until the mind becomes stable, calm, and clear. Then, you know, we need to be able to enter blankness of mu. So we have to be able to enter stable mind, samadhi mind, right? And that involves one-pointedness of awareness and then purification of the body, right? And then that's a deepening of samadhi. Then we have to go to mu, okay? And this is very different. And now, when you're working on the mu koan, see, eventually karma begins to be cleared away, and then an interesting thing will start to happen. Now, it may not exactly happen like this, because sometimes these obstacles don't get in the way as much, but when you're calling mu, 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 mu on the cushion, you may begin to feel strangely energized. See, strangely energized. In other words, one of the characteristics of a deep samadhi experience is this serenity and stillness, which is absolutely indispensable. But when you begin to work with the mu koan and you begin to clear away karma, you may feel a stirring of something that is not exactly serene. It may be like a powerful energy. Now this can happen even before you begin to work with your karma. If you're just starting with the mu koan, you can feel this surge of energy. And then the karmic obstacles begin to close that off. But eventually, you will begin to feel this surge of energy. And my advice to you is don't try to hold on to the energy. Just keep entering that blankness, that emptiness, and the energy, when it's ready, will return. Okay, so this is the wonderful aspect of mu that's so important. Life energy is flowing through us all the time. In fact, we are life energy, but we feel lifeless and energyless and unhappy and dead a lot of the time because we have all of these obstacles that arrest the flow of energy. So when we clear away karma, energy begins to flow in an unobstructed way. And it flows and it flows more and more freely as we work with the mu koan. And that we can deepen our practice of mu forever, and the energy becomes greater and greater. And this is life itself, Buddha itself, pure awareness itself. So this is the path up to the mu koan. And I just wanted to lay it out in this way. I hope it's somewhat clear. So and nobody's too confused about going off track. It's if you're having lots of thoughts and you're working on the mu koan, there isn't a problem. It's what I said. You know, it's what I said. If you're in samadhi and I just gave you the mu koan and you're feeling, wait a minute, this is not so great. You know, it's like in samadhi, it's just wonderful. And then I say, oh great, wonderful, congratulations, and now work on the mu koan. And now you feel like, wait a minute, I'm sort of murky. I don't know where I'm going. This is not so cool, you know, this is not so great. Don't worry. There's going to be something wonderful down the road. Just, you know, please, trust me. Everybody's somewhere probably along this continuum, Just, you're doing, do your best. You're doing a wonderful job. Don't pass judgment on yourself. Just do your best. You know, if you haven't done your best, then, you know, feel free to judge yourself. You know. But if you've done your best, you know, don't, whatever you do, don't judge yourself. Just say, I did my best. And then it's just in Edo Roshi, Edo Shimano Roshi, has a wonderful saying about, I think it's, he often talks about, in the readiness of time. Now, I think that's so important in Zen practice because, you know, everything is going to unfold in its own time. My own teacher, Genki Roshi, used to say, you know, you can't break the door down. You just have to sit at the door and knock, and it will open when it's ready to open. Yeah? So just, if you sit on the cushion, straighten the back, struggle with your pain, use the breath to sweep away pain, use mood to sweep away pain, and use mood to sweep away fatigue, tiredness, feelings of, doubts, whatever. You're just doing a wonderful job. Just keep going, I promise you won't be disappointed.